This is an ABC podcast.
Hello and welcome to The World Today. I'm Sally Sara. This Wednesday, as climate change takes hold, farmers find new ways to put food on people's tables. And Xi Jinping's crackdown on corruption in China, could it backfire?
He's made so many powerful enemies, destroyed so many powerful, rich, privileged families. If he were ever to step down, he would be in danger of being arrested himself.
But first, the banking regulator APRA has responded to scathing criticisms that it's timid and too close to the companies it regulates. APRA Chairman Wayne Byers says he supports all 19 recommendations from a capability review in response to the Banking Royal Commission's final report. The watchdog is now under intense pressure to overhaul its image, but wants more government funding to do it. The ABC's senior business correspondent Peter Ryan is covering the fallout from the review, and he joins me now. Peter, the independent review says that APRA actually has some of the same cultural problems that it's supposed to be weeding out in corporate Australia. How has it responded to that?
Well, APRA Chairman Wayne Byers made the point that APRA is managing or overseeing or protecting around $6.5 trillion worth of assets in Australia. So it's a critically important of Australia's financial landscape. But in that report, as you mentioned, APRA has been accused of being a behind-the-scenes regulator, at times secretive and not always a great communicator with the public. So late this morning, in a rare move, APRA's Chairman Wayne Byers countered some of that criticism by holding an on-the-record press conference over the telephone. My TV colleagues were told no cameras were allowed. That's despite revelations earlier this year that APRA spent $430,000 on presentation skills training with NIDA, that's the National Institute of Dramatic Art. And those skills might come in handy as the heat has turned up on APRA to become a more modern and more feared regulator, a real enforcer. But this morning, Wayne Byers was upbeat while accepting the review headed by the former ACCC boss, Graeme Samuel, which has made some pretty big recommendations. But he had a big message for the federal government, and that is, show me the money.
The key challenge posed by the report, as has been the case for reviews by the IMF and the Productivity Commission, the Royal Commission, and now the Capability Review, is that they all identify a whole range of areas where APRA needs to do more, but without providing any suggestion on where it might do less. And indeed, the Capability Review emphasises that APRA is, notwithstanding recent budget increases, still a pretty lean regulator in terms of resourcing. You know, as a leader of an organisation, I understand as well as anyone, these issues around culture, leadership, behaviours, there's no silver bullet here.
That's the APRA chairman, Wayne Byers. So the future of APRA, Peter, is now a hot political issue. What reaction has there been in Canberra?
Well, earlier today, the Treasurer, Josh Frydenberg, says that he will be taking actions on the five recommendations that are directed at the federal government. Meanwhile, the Shadow Treasurer, Jim Chalmers, has jumped on the report, not surprisingly. Without criticising APRA's top brass, he says both the government and APRA have a very long way to go in rebuilding trust, but that importantly, no one should ever forget about the source of the shocking misconduct.
The biggest problems uncovered by the Hayne Royal Commission were problems in the banks themselves. And we shouldn't let today's focus on APRA let the banks off the hook for a lot of the bad behaviour which was uncovered there, some extraordinarily appalling behaviour from the banks. And we need to make sure that the focus post-Royal Commission is on cleaning up that bad behaviour. But at the same time, obviously, APRA and the government need to lift their game when it comes to supervising and policing the sector.
That's the Shadow Treasurer, Jim Chalmers. Peter Ryan, thank you very much for joining us. Well, concerns have been raised about the independence of Chinese language teachers in schools and universities. The ABC has revealed that the Confucius Institute requires teachers to pledge loyalty to the motherland before being allowed to teach Mandarin. It's raised the ire of human rights groups, but some China watchers say there's not necessarily anything to worry about. Isabel Rowe reports.
The teaching of Chinese language is a particularly sensitive issue for Tibetan father Sonam Paljor.
I would not want to go, my kids to go in such a school.
The Western Sydney resident has young children at a school where Mandarin is taught by teachers from the Confucius Institute. Mr. Paljor says his daughter has come home confused after children in the playground told her that Tibet was part of China, not a view his family shares.
The presence of the institute in our school environment undermines what is one of the key tenets of our school environment, that is to provide a safe and inclusive environment.
Confucius Institute language programs are overseen by Chinese government agency Hanban. Teacher applications require the applicant to have good political and professional qualities and love the motherland. Swinburne University of Technology China expert John Fitzgerald says what good political quality means is that you accept wholeheartedly the beliefs of the Chinese Communist Party. And Sonam Paljor believes those politics are creeping into his child's classroom.
People think they're just another language with some free textbooks and free, few computers being provided by somebody who don't know who. And I think if people know more information, if the schools explain who these teachers are.
Human Rights Watch director Elaine Pearson is also concerned.
We've got children of a very impressionable age studying in these classrooms. Are those the sorts of values that we want to be teaching them?
In May last year, then-Minister for Education Rob Stokes ordered a review of the risks associated with language programs underpinned by relationships with foreign governments or organisations. That review is due to be published next month. Several universities, including the University of Sydney, accept funding from the Confucius Institute. In a statement, a university spokeswoman says it only receives modest funding support and the majority of the Institute's staff are already university employees. She also says their partner university in China, Fudan University, makes initial recommendations on a deputy director and one or two teachers, but that the university has the final say on whether to accept that. Flinders University academic Geoffrey Gill has already researched the issues. He says the primary school curriculum doesn't teach children about Chinese political issues, but nor should it.
The Confucius Institutes and classrooms try to portray China in a positive light and focus on the positive aspects of China while ignoring the more controversial issues. In that sense, they're selective rather than being overtly propagandistic. I'm not sure of the relevance of dealing with issues like Tibet or the Tiananmen Square massacre in a primary school language class.
So I suppose you don't see the current situation as of any great concern, really, especially in primary school?
I think schools should go into these relationships with their eyes open, but so far I haven't seen any evidence of a Confucius classroom or a Confucius Institute actually getting control over the curriculum.
ABC has contacted Hanban and the Confucius Institute for comment.
That's Isabel Rowe reporting. Staying with China, and Chinese President Xi Jinping is escalating his anti-corruption drive and demands for a return to party values. Richard McGregor is a senior fellow at the Lowy Institute and an experienced China watcher. He's written a new paper called Xi Jinping, The Backlash. It examines reactions to the Chinese leader's hardline style at home and abroad. I spoke to him a short time ago.
Well, he's been in power now for 5-6 years. We should know a lot about him. If you think about US presidents, other powerful people in the world, we know a ton about them. In the case of Donald Trump, we know too much probably. But with Xi Jinping, we're still sort of putting the puzzle together. We know when he was sort of first selected, not elected for the job, that, he's red nobility. His father was a famous revolutionary. He's also come up through the system. He served in lots of different parts of China, so he's well qualified like that. But when he was first chosen in 2007 to take over in 2012, nobody tipped that he would be as tough, as authoritarian a leader as he is. So the question about him, why did he come to office with such alacrity? And I think there's two elements to that. Number one, in the years before he came to office, other high-level leaders tried to take the job off him. They've since been arrested, Bo Xilai being the most prominent amongst them. But secondly, I think that he's a dedicated member of the Communist Party, an absolute true believer that the Communist Party, only the Communist Party, has the right to rule China. He saw the party crumbling from corruption, from fiefdoms developing, from a slackness in the system. So he's tried to sort of rattle the whole thing and tighten it up. And that's why we see China being led in the way that it is today.
I want to ask you about his anti-corruption push. How do you see that? Some are seeing the benefits in cracking down on corruption, but at the same time, he's making a lot of enemies because he's going after a large number of people and their patronage networks then extend a lot further. So people are being dispossessed, losing their status. So is it good for him or bad, and good for China or not?
Well, I think there's a number of ways of looking at it. First of all, there's fertile ground for an anti-corruption campaign because there was systematic corruption in the Communist Party, and that's one thing that makes ordinary people very angry. So it threatened the party's legitimacy. I don't think it's true, as some say, that he's just used anti-corruption to take out his enemies. Certainly that's happened a little bit, but it's much bigger than that. But the impact of the anti-corruption campaign is much like in any political system where you have a big clean-out or somebody cleans out tons of people. He has created enormous numbers of enemies, bad enemies perhaps. This is one of the themes of my book. And it also goes to explain why he's decided that he's made himself leader in perpetuity, because I think he's made so many powerful enemies, destroyed so many powerful, rich, privileged families, you know, overnight, as you can do with the executive power of a Communist Party leader, that if he were ever to step down himself, he, or at least his family members or associates and acolytes, would be in danger of being arrested himself. So the anti-corruption campaign has a far-reaching impact beyond just the anti-corruption element, but into the entire body politic.
What about his push of having more influence of the party in private enterprise? A lot of Australians find that difficult to understand. How does this actually happen? Are we talking about seats at the table at board meetings, or how does that work?
Yeah, it's still a little bit opaque. Foreigners even struggle to understand that the party has a fundamental role in big state-owned companies. PetroChina and the like are known down here, but in private company as well. Alibaba, for example, Huawei, a private company, Tencent, the biggest sort of internet company, that all the leaders of those companies are members of the party, and all of those companies have party committees. Now, what do they actually do? If you talk to the Chinese, they'll try and play it down and say, oh, it's simply HR. If there's a personnel dispute, the party committee can handle that and manage it. But increasingly, the party wants to make sure it's involved in executive decisions as well. So, and effectively, they might act like a shadow board. But of course, they don't say what they do, so we don't really know. And so I think for, you know, Chinese companies, Chinese listed companies in Hong Kong and the like, it's certainly something that investors are increasingly focused on.
All of this is unfolding against the backdrop of a trade war with the US and China. Where does that leave Australia, all of these factors playing out at the moment?
In some respects, uncomfortably in the middle. We're already offside with China. You know, so are many other countries. Australia's not alone. If you look around the world, all manner of countries are battling with China and renegotiating their relationship with China in many ways. As far as economically, you know, in the short term, the trade war doesn't hurt us too much. Now, if the US and China were to do these short-term trade deals where China agrees to buy a bunch of agriculture, farm goods and LNG and the like from the US to reduce the bilateral trade imbalance, that could hurt us. But at the moment, our economy is still complementary to China's. We still sell them stuff that they don't have, as much as they dislike relying on us. So we're not in any immediate danger, because for China to try to punish Australia economically for political ends, let alone the impact of fallout of a trade war, that hurts China as well. More broadly speaking, US-China trade war is affecting trade globally. It's reducing trade globally. It's cutting economic growth rates globally. So in the short term, that is bad for us as well.
Richard McGregor, thank you.
Thank you.
That's Richard McGregor, Senior Fellow at the Lowy Institute. This is The World Today, and if you miss a program, you can find us on the ABC Listen app or subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. You can also follow us on Facebook and on Twitter at ABC News. Farmers and scientists are finding new ways to keep food on the table as rainfall patterns change and heat waves increase. Climate change is affecting what's grown and consumed, as those on the front line produce food differently. National rural and regional reporter Jess Davis has this story.
On the edge of the Gawler River in South Australia, farmer Anne-Marie Brookman has been ripping up pistachio, walnut and apple trees.
I guess that's the tough decisions that you have to make. The sad thing is pulling them out, but the good thing is seeing how other things cope.
She planted the pistachios 30 years ago because they grow with relatively little water and tolerate high temperatures, but they rely on wind to chill to regenerate, and it's no longer cold enough. Her apples and pears can no longer cope with increasing heat waves.
Nothing had a chance to recover overnight and start, you know, the next day afresh. We just found that it completely cooked the apples and the nashis.
But like many farmers across the country, Anne-Marie Brookman is adapting what and how she grows.
You know, we've already had good crops of pomegranates and we've had good crops of jujubes, so I guess all is not lost.
Professor Richard Eckard from the University of Melbourne says agriculture relies on a predictable local climate.
So every crop exists where it does because we know the distribution of rainfall and we know the distribution of temperature. Climate change threatens those. It threatens the rainfall and it threatens the temperature regimes that a crop or a system is adapted to.
The declining rainfall is challenging many farmers. But for others, like West Australian farmer Mark Adams, their once too wet land is now perfect for growing crops.
We've been adapting for the last 30 years and I don't think we're going to stop adapting to what the climate throws at us.
Lower rainfall means his crops no longer get waterlogged. And with better farming techniques, Mr. Adams has increased his productivity by 25%.
I don't have a fear in regards to climate change. We've managed with the changes to date and we've increased our production.
At Weeman in northwest Victoria, Angelo Lamatina's family has been growing carrots for nearly 30 years.
The reason why we chose the area we're in is because it had plenty of water, the soil was perfect for growing carrots, and the climate conditions were also perfect.
But hotter, drier conditions have made it harder for him to grow carrots.
The point is, it's actually the climate is changing, and so we need to adapt.
Angelo Lamatina has bought two more properties in cooler climates, where he grows during the summer months, instead of growing all year round at his family farm.
By doing what we've done, droughts can come and go and not affect our business as much as they would have 20 years ago.
But as climate change accelerates, Professor Richard Eckard says there needs to be more investment from both state and federal governments so food producers can keep up.
A lot of research is still needed to understand what are the adaptation options and to progress some of the adaptation options, because if they are about breeding shorter season varieties, well, we actually need quite a long lead time to get there. It doesn't happen tomorrow.
In a statement to the ABC, the Federal Agriculture Minister says the Australian government has a suite of measures to support climate change adaptation.
That was Jess Davis with that story. The US Attorney General has decided not to pursue civil rights charges against the officer involved in the death of African-American man Eric Garner 5 years ago. Mr. Garner's arrest attracted world attention due to a video in which he said, "I can't breathe," 11 times after being placed in an apparent chokehold. And a warning, this story may be distressing to some listeners. North America correspondent Zoe Daniel reports.
On the eve of the fifth anniversary of Eric Garner's death, US Attorney General William Barr has decided not to proceed with civil rights charges against NYPD officer Daniel Pantaleo. Eric Garner's mother, Gwen Carr.
"This is an outrage, an insult to injury. You killed my son and you won't get away with it."
A grand jury previously declined to indict the officer on criminal charges after doubt was cast on whether the way he restrained Eric Garner caused his death. United States Attorney for the Eastern District of New York, Richard P. Donohue.
"We've determined that we as the prosecutors are not convinced that this particular defendant or potential defendant committed the offence."
It was in 2014 on a footpath near the Staten Island ferry terminal in New York that police stopped Eric Garner on suspicion of illegally selling cigarettes.
"I did not sell nothing because every time you see me, you want to harass me, you want to stop me, you want to sell cigarettes. I'm minding my business, officer."
A mobile phone video taken by a friend went global. It shows him being held around the neck and wrestled to the ground. He makes it clear that he can't breathe.
Give us your hand, buddy. Put your hand, buddy. I can't breathe.
Eric Garner was taken to hospital where he was pronounced dead. Lawyers for the officer involved have argued that inappropriate force was not used and that he didn't use a chokehold, which is banned. The police union argued that Garner was resisting arrest and that asthma, diabetes and heart issues contributed to his death. Nevertheless, when a grand jury refused to indict the officer, protests broke out. Richard P. Donohue.
We are committed to aggressively prosecuting excessive force cases whenever there is sufficient evidence to bring them.
Eric Garner's death was one of the first to put police treatment of unarmed African-American men in the spotlight. Serious questions were raised about whether police were initially honest about what unfolded before the video came out and whether medical assistance was timely. It was followed by several more deaths of Michael Brown in Ferguson, Missouri, Freddie Gray in Baltimore and others that faced a new level of scrutiny. Now, Eric Garner's family is vowing to fight for the officer involved in his death to be dismissed from the force. Daughter, Emerald Snipes.
Where's the justice? Don't apologize to me. Fire the officer. Don't give me your condolences. I heard that 5 years ago. We want justice and we want it today.
Daniel Pantaleo's been on desk duty since the incident. It'll be up to the New York Police Commissioner to decide what happens now. In Washington, this is Zoe Daniel reporting for The World Today.
As concerns grow about high blood pressure causing thousands of premature deaths, there are calls for radical salt reduction targets in Australia's food industry. A Victorian study has found that parents are trying to reduce their children's salt intake, but find it difficult to grapple with food labels that refer to salt as sodium. Food manufacturers say they're already taking steps to reduce salt content and warn a major overhaul could have unintended consequences. Gavin Coote has this report.
As Isabella loads up her basket with groceries, she's closely studying the nutritional information in the breakfast aisle.
I'm having a look at the sugar and the sugar and the fibre. Yeah.
What about sodium? Is that something that you take into account?
Not at all. I would not even know what a sodium rating meant.
In the snack aisle, father of two, Ben Finn, isn't paying much attention to sodium levels either.
I do consider it, but it's not high on the list of sort of danger items I'm looking at.
This confusion about the level of salt content is now being highlighted in a Deakin University study. The team surveyed more than 2,000 adults on their understanding of healthy salt intake and found confusion is rife among parents in particular. Lead author Ajam Koka says many parents looking to cut down on salt become unstuck with labels that refer to sodium.
It is very common for the two terms to be confused and to be used interchangeably as well. Salt actually contains about 40% sodium and 60% chloride.
The study calls for a consistent front-of-pack labelling system to help demystify how much salt's in a product. The Heart Foundation says nearly three-quarters of Victorian schoolchildren far exceed the recommended limits of salt, less than a teaspoon per day, affecting their blood pressure from an early age and putting them at risk of heart disease and strokes in the future. Kellyanne Jolly is the Foundation's Victorian CEO.
It's also really important that we work with the food manufacturers and government to reformulate the food, to actually reduce the amount of salt, particularly in our processed foods, because that's where most of our salt is hidden.
She acknowledges the food industry is already working to reduce salt levels in many products, but is urging for efforts to be stepped up.
We will see a reduction not only in the population salt intake, but we will see, it could be up to 9,000 premature deaths a year being prevented. That's what we've seen in the UK as a result of this work.
Dr. Geoffrey Anderson is the Deputy CEO of the Australian Food and Grocery Council. He says big changes in the food industry overnight could do more harm than good.
If you make radical changes, then consumers just stop buying the products and they'll
you know, move to other products that might not result in a reduction in their salt intake. So I think it's a combination of sensible labelling plus educating consumers to look at the nutrition information panel and slowly changing the food supply through reformulation of individual products in a direction that is consistent with that advised in the dietary guidelines.
That's Geoffrey Annison from the Australian Food and Grocery Council. That's all from the World Today team this Wednesday. I'm Sally Sara. Have a lovely afternoon.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.